Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've all seen those Depression-era pictures of hunger. WPA photographers made the now-famous black-and-white images of gaunt-faced Dust Bowl migrants, their barefoot kids in rags, that migrant mother staring off into the middle distance, brow knit in desperation. Hunger in America today is different. For one, it's called food insecurity. It's a reality for one in six Americans, and it's not so obvious, especially since it's linked to the nation's swelling obesity rate. Tracy McMillan is an author and investigative journalist who wrote What Does Hunger Look Like? It's a feature in National Geographic magazine. The article provides a close-up of the new face of hunger through several families who live with it, along with current data on food costs, availability, policy, and habits. Tracy McMillan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Unlike during the Depression, many of today's food insecure are actually working. Tell us about one of those couples, Jim and Christine Dreyer.
Yeah, so Christina and Jim live in Mitchell County, Iowa. It's up on the northern border with Minnesota. And Jim, when I met him, was working applying pesticides for a commercial farm, making $14 an hour. They take care of three kids. And Christina finished high school, but she did the math. And, you know, as a high school graduate and nothing else, you know, going and getting a job would probably get her $7-8 an hour. And that wouldn't cover the cost of the daycare for their three kids. So she stays at home with them. And so they get some assistance from SNAP, from, you know, colloquially we think of that as food stamps. And what was really interesting when I spent time with her was to realize that for the Dreyer family, food is this constant worry for them, where they're constantly worried about how they're going to get enough food and enough healthy food to feed their kids. And for me, that was really striking, right? Even though I've covered poverty for a long time, I hadn't made that connection that, you know, part of the stress of being in the working poor in America is that you might actually run out of food.
What do they actually eat and how? You mentioned that they get SNAP assistance, but what and how do they actually eat?
Sure. So families like the Dreyers get by with a mix of SNAP and food bank. A lot of food banks let you come in once or twice a month, something like that. So in Mitchell County, you go once a month. And you know, like all food banks, they need to have food that is shelf stable and isn't going to go bad. So you have a lot of very salty, very sugary foods, right? Those are the preservatives that keep food from going bad over the long haul. Certainly food banks try to get in produce as much as they can, but it's very difficult, right, to sort of handle something that's going to go bad over time. And so for the Dreyers, their diet is based on the stuff they get from the food bank, and then it's supplemented with the fresh stuff they can get with SNAP. So there's a little bit of meat and cheese, a little bit of produce. You know, Christina told me that the start of the month is her favorite time to go to the grocery store because she has the SNAP, it hasn't run out yet, and she can get fruits and vegetables for her kids.
How much do they actually get in the form of SNAP assistance from the U.S. government for their family of five?
Right. So the Dreyers, when I met them, were getting, I think, about $175 a month. That fluctuates, as it does for most families, because it's based on your income. You know, maybe every 3 months, every 6 months, you know, the government comes in and checks and makes sure that you're getting the proper amount. And I know that, you know, for somebody like Jim, who works in a seasonal industry, you know, you get into the dead of winter, he's working far fewer hours than he is in November and October when harvest is going on. He is working overtime.
How do the Dreyers fit into the current numbers and trends of food insecurity inside the U.S.?
The Dreyers are very emblematic of a lot of the basic trends that we see with hunger in the U.S. They're white. More than half of folks who are food insecure in this country are white. They're working, which is the case for 75% of households who are food insecure. And that actually breaks down to about 59% have someone working full-time and another 15%, 16% are working part-time. They're also living in a rural area where there's quite a lot of food insecurity as well as urban. You know, I think we tend to think of hunger as either being Depression era, or if we modernize it, you know, it's maybe a single low-income man of color in line at a soup kitchen in, a dirty block in a city. And what I really saw in reporting this piece for National Geographic is that food insecurity is not marginal at all, right? It's absolutely part of the American mainstream.
It's an irony that you discovered so much in the heartland, where billions of bushels of corn and soy are produced every year. What is the connection there between the foods that are subsidized by the U.S. government and food insecurity?
Yeah, so right now we have a real disconnect between what we say our nutritional priorities are and what our agricultural priorities are. We spend probably about 8 times as much money subsidizing commodity crops, which includes corn, cotton, wheat, things like that. Corn is the top subsidy getter, as opposed to subsidizing fruits and vegetables. And yet, if you go and you look at the MyPlate recommendations, we're supposed to be getting half of our calories from fruits and vegetables and about a quarter from grain. So there's a real disconnect between what we say people should be eating and what kind of food we're making sure is available to everybody. I think that the government has a role to play in making sure that Americans can get healthy diets. But, we end up paying a lot of costs in terms of health, in terms of productivity, when we have a population that's not healthy.
We're talking about the new face of hunger with Tracy McMillan, whose article in National Geographic traveled to several cities and towns in the U.S. and introduced us to families living with hunger and the policy and the habits and the growing obesity among America's food insecure. This, Tracy, was a big topic of conversation when $5 billion was taken out of the SNAP, that's food stamps, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, last fall. Now, what has that done to average family budgets and what they can spend on food from SNAP?
Right. So the SNAP cuts just mean that families have less money. I believe actually with the Dreyer family, they had been getting, I think it was about $225 a month, and that was cut by about $50 when those cuts went through. And that's when I met them. That makes a real difference in terms of what families are able to put on the table for their kids.
What would that break down to meal by meal? Did you work that out?
Meal by meal, I know that the average SNAP benefit in the country is about $1.35 to $1.50 per person per meal.
What can you buy for $1.50?
Well, if you think about what it costs to get fruits and vegetables at the market, you can get maybe, what is that, a third of a pound of tomatoes in season, right? They're about $3, $4 a pound. You could get a couple bags of potato chips if they're on sale. You could probably get several liters of soda. You could get, I would assume, about half a loaf of bread. So when you're dealing with, budgets that are this minuscule, right, when you're looking at trying to feed a family on $5 a meal, it really gears people's diets towards whatever is going to be cheap enough to buy in bulk. That means something that's not going to go bad. So that just keeps moving you further and further away from the fruits and vegetables we know folks should be eating.
I'm going to go back to that debate about SNAP, because I remember hearing or reading a lot of arguments about if people can afford cars, if they can afford cell phones, if they can afford flat screen TVs, can't they afford to feed their family? What did you find about this population of people who look as if they have everything but are still food insecure?
Right. So something that we tend to gloss over when we look at the fact that, a low-income family might have a nice-looking outfit on or they might have a car is that the cost of a car is something that you can't get around if you want to have a job, right? And you've got to have decent clothing if you want to go to work. So if we want families to be working, right, those are things that they kind of need to have. Food is really interesting because it's one of the few expenditures that is very flexible, right? So if you are living on a very tight budget, you can't do anything about the cost of gas and having to get to your job. You can't do very much at all about the cost of your car. You can't do too much about the cost of your house, but you can budget on food and you can go and get help with that somewhere else. And that's what we see people doing.
I wonder also if, because people have cars, what do you call them, the SUV poor? I'm trying to remember in the article, the SUV poor. They look as if they have everything, that there's a little less empathy for them. They don't look like the Dust Bowl farmers. And maybe there's a little less willingness to support SNAP or other programs that might help people who are hungry.
Yeah, there is definitely much less empathy for families that still have some of the trappings of a middle-class lifestyle. With the Great Recession, what we saw was a lot of families that had been living middle-class lives. So they had a house with a mortgage. They had a car. And what happens is they lose their job. And then they're trying to make ends meet and they're thinking of this as a temporary problem. And so you don't immediately sell the house. You don't immediately get rid of the car. You don't immediately pull the kids out of all their after school activities. You start budgeting as best you can. And that often leads people into the food bank.
Well, Tracy, a fascinating article and certainly eye-opening. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating and a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. She also wrote the article, The New Face of Hunger, for National Geographic magazine. You'll find a link to read the article and see photographs of some of the families that she talked about on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. More than 46 million Americans are currently on the Supplemental Nutrition, or SNAP, program. As of April of this year, the average monthly benefit per person was $124.70. That's just over $4 a day. SNAP assistance here in New Hampshire is the lowest in the nation, at $3.84 a day. With a pint of blueberries costing about $2.99, a cucumber totaling 50 cents, and a single red bell pepper ringing up at about a dollar, what does mealtime look like to somebody on a SNAP budget? And what does it take to eat a balanced diet on just $4 a day? The Food Research and Action Center brings those numbers to life in its SNAP Challenge, encouraging people to try living on the average daily food stamp benefit for just 1 week. I spoke to the program's legal director, Ellen Vollinger, to break down the numbers and find out how people have responded to the SNAP Challenge.
We have gotten a lot of reports from people who've taken the SNAP Challenge. Number one, they do find it difficult to afford a balanced diet. They typically, when they go and do their shopping trip, find it very difficult to shop within that budget and often get to the checkout line and find that they're somewhat over and literally need to, you know, take another cabbage back to the produce aisle or something else off the cart. So as a matter of figuring out what things cost and trying to get what they might even be used to on that amount of money, they find quite a challenge, quite difficult. One of the other things, however, that we hear from people who take the SNAP Challenge is how surprised they are by the monotony of what they've been consuming over a week, the lack of variety and the monotony of it, as well as the lack of their usual social interaction. I think sometimes people forget how much they're interacting with other people for meals. And so sometimes if somebody's on the SNAP Challenge and they're used to going out to a restaurant with somebody, they either won't go or won't eat at the restaurant. And it's just a different way of interacting than they're used to. And I suppose one of the other things that we hear pretty regularly is how much time it takes to be involved in trying to eat on that amount of money. Mm-hmm. With that often comes no real wiggle room for error.
Well, let's go through some meal plans, I'd say, for a family of four that could be afforded on the SNAP budget. Give me a sample breakfast.
You know, it really depends. You know, some people may be choosing cereals. They may be choosing toast. There's not a lot of room for fruits, probably. Some of it will be, you know, what people are choosing, I suppose, and some of it may be what they can get people around the table to eat. But it's not a lot of money. When you're talking about $4 a person a day, how you break that out, you may be talking about a dollar for the breakfast. It depends, you know, if they're spending more on the breakfast, less on the lunch, more on the dinner. It's not a lot of money.
You mentioned the monotony that people discovered on the SNAP Challenge. What's a sort of typical meal that's affordable for a family on a SNAP budget?
Well, I'll give you an example. Congressman Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, who took the SNAP Challenge, ate a lot of lentils the first time that he took the challenge and reported afterward that he probably didn't want to look at another lentil. So some of it is, you know, picking things that might be that might help you stretch, might fill the belly, and frankly, that you might even like. But if that's really something you're eating all the time or quite a bit by the end of even just the week, that gets pretty tiresome.
Ellen Vollinger, legal director at the Food Research and Action Center. You can find more on the SNAP Challenge, including those who've done it, and maybe take on the challenge yourself. There's a link for more at wordofmouthradio.org. A bitter fight is brewing in Washington. Instead of listing total sugar content, as law currently stipulates, the FDA wants to require food manufacturers to disclose all added sugars on their labels as well. And while it is no secret that the American diet has become more sugar-laden in recent years, the numbers are staggering. 200 years ago, the average American ate approximately 2 pounds of sugar a year. Today, it's 152 pounds. While the rise of big ag, processed food, and government subsidies have greatly contributed to sugar consumption, America's sweet tooth may have roots in a single event in history. Word of Mouth's Maureen McMurray talked with Nick Capodice, education associate at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City, about how prohibition altered America's palate.
America can't drink booze for 13 years. And what happens in those 13 years revolutionizes the American palate. So, first thing is, we've got, let's say, about 1,000, 2,000 breweries in the United States. How on earth are they going to stay open if they can't make beer anymore? Well, they turn to two main things. A lot of them make cereal because they have a lot of grain, but then a ton of them make soda instead. So you have this huge push from, you know, marketing executives for these breweries to get these guys to sell soda all across the country. It's also being sort of, you know, sold to the American public as a healthy, temperate alternative to drinking beer. But, of course, people who want to get drunk still get drunk, and they go to speakeasies, right? But the next big shift is what fails in America, and that's restaurants. As soon as prohibition hits, like, fine-quality dining ceases to exist in the United States of America. Because you know how restaurants make their money, right?
Booze.
Booze, that's it. That's like all their money they make from booze to this day, a venerable restaurant tradition. So fine dining restaurants just shutter across the country. Dining disappeared. The lunch disappeared. But what does survive is the diner, the automat, the ice cream shop. These like cheap, inexpensive places you go to eat something kind of, you know, filling but not too impressive. This begins one of the big rises towards, you know, fast food culture in America. And then more stuff changed, too, which was a great many people in America were still drinking, as you know, during Prohibition. But they were drinking really rough stuff, like bad gin, bad whiskey, iodine, fusel oil was in it, all this bad stuff. So they had to find a way to mask it. And this is the first time, in like in U.S. history, that people start having cocktails. You'd mix, like, whiskey and Coke. Never before would you have had a whiskey and Coke until you have to hide the taste of that whiskey. And so during Prohibition, sweet mixers for booze get on the rise. It's a huge shift in the American palate because people, during the 13 years of Prohibition, they eat more and more sugar. So when it's finally lifted, they want drinks that are cold and sweet and, you know, innocuous.
That's Nick Capodice, education associate at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City. NASCAR drivers can reach speeds of 200-plus miles an hour. Remarkably, when wrecks do occur, racers overwhelmingly survive. They don't always walk away unscathed. Up next, concussions in NASCAR and the challenges drivers face after the smoke clears. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The recent death of Kevin Ward Jr. at Canandaigua Motorsport Park provoked questions about confrontations between drivers throughout the history of professional racing. Ward was killed when he left the relative safety of his car and was struck by three-time NASCAR champ Tony Stewart's car. Wrecks happen all the time in professional motor racing. Drivers overwhelmingly survive these accidents, but they don't all walk away unscathed. Viv Bernstein is a freelance journalist who highlights the challenges that face NASCAR drivers after the smoke clears. We found her article, Crashing Without a Cushion, NASCAR Drivers Have Little Help with Concussions, in the New York Times. And Viv, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for inviting me.
The legacy of concussions and head injuries has become a huge challenge and story in football and boxing and other professional sports. Do we have any idea of how many drivers are affected in racing?
That's a very difficult question to answer because there is no union. There is nobody tracking these older drivers. Nobody really knows some of the symptoms that they're dealing with 20, 30, 40 years after they raced. Back in the day, before there were soft walls, before there were other safety measures, these guys took crazy, crazy hits to their heads and continued racing, and they thought nothing of it at the time. Mm. They didn't realize how dangerous it could be. So, yeah, there could be dozens, there could be hundreds, who knows, of drivers who have experienced head injuries and are feeling those symptoms even today.
And you speak with a number of drivers, some who were recently hurt, some, as you mentioned, you know, were hurt dozens of years ago. The crashes are not always catastrophic. I mean, sometimes drivers just keep on driving. How common is that for racers?
Again, it's very hard to answer because it's really up to the racers to say, hey, I am hurt. I should not be on the racetrack. Drivers typically don't do that. And athletes are trained, mentally trained, to push forward through injury. That's something you see in every sport. Not surprising to see that in racing as well. What Dale Earnhardt Jr. did 2 years ago when he stepped out of the car and said, hey, I have a problem. I've had some concussions. That was almost unprecedented in NASCAR, sent a huge message to others in the racing community. However, I still think today there are drivers who take hits to the head and keep racing.
Well, Dale Earnhardt Sr. died in the 2001 Daytona 500, and since then, new safety regulations have been put in place. So is NASCAR responsible for helping in driver recovery or expenses in case of injuries?
Well, NASCAR has insulated itself from responsibility. In the way the organization is structured, these drivers are independent contractors. There is no union. There is nobody looking out for them except for them. You're not going to see the lawsuits that you've seen in the NHL, that you've seen in the NFL. However, these drivers helped build that sport. They helped to build that sport into a machine that can generate an $8.2 billion television contract. These drivers who help build the sport, perhaps NASCAR can help them, given that they're generating these kinds of dollars.
Well, NASCAR drivers operate on many different levels. Some are paid, like professional sports stars. Some have big sponsorships. Others are just kind of making a living race by race. Do they all have the same kind of risks in the end?
Absolutely. Now, NASCAR is just like other sports. There are major leagues, there are minor leagues, there are stars, and there are other guys who are there who are not stars, who just race every week and live off the money they make every week. And yeah, it's a burden to have to be able to support themselves if they have these major catastrophic injuries.
Yeah, no safety net. Well, you spent a lot of time with one such driver, Eric McClure, not a particularly winning driver, but he did crash at Talladega, Alabama in 2012. He was kind of a second-tier driver living race to race, and he felt he had no choice but to continue racing despite his injuries. First, what were his injuries?
Well, he had a horrific crash at Talladega. Talladega is a racetrack known for its crashes, these multi-car, 12-car, 15-car pileups. The way racing is designed at those tracks, it creates those wrecks. In McClure's case, he had lost his brakes. So when he crashed and went streaming towards the inside wall, he couldn't slow himself down. He hit the wall at 185 miles an hour. Now, understand, he had a much more catastrophic crash than the one that killed Dale Earnhardt. However, NASCAR has so many ways to improve, has improved racing safety dramatically since that crash, and that's why McClure survived. However, he was knocked unconscious. He had a severe concussion. He had internal injuries that have caused issues for years since then. He has now memory issues. He has now mood issues. These are all signs of some significant brain damage. And yet he has to continue racing, even though he is now at risk, if he gets another concussion, for some very serious issues much further down the line.
NASCAR, you tell us, has initiated concussion tests at the beginning and end of each season. Eric, however, is still racing. Is there an incentive for him to lie about concussions or to continue racing even if injured?
Well, first of all, I don't know that Eric McClure has or would lie about injuries. However, there's a tremendous incentive to keep racing, even though he risks further damage. Given the number of concussions he's had, he's already had three significant concussions in his career. The more concussions he has, the greater risk he has down the line. But there's a tremendous incentive to just keep racing. Now, I'm not saying that he has lied about anything, but there is an incentive to keep for drivers in general to not reveal their concussions and to continue racing. Jeff Gordon, a four-time champion, was asked about that after Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s injury, asked if he would withhold information if he had a concussion, if it meant it would cost him a championship. And he said, yes, he would. Jeff is one of the most respected drivers in NASCAR, and for him to say that sends a message to drivers all the way down to Eric McClure as well.
And you spent time with a number of former racers who, I guess, this kind of crashing and just driving on behavior had been sort of normalized. Now some of them struggling with long-term effects of hits to the head, and you spoke to, you know, doctors at Boston University about these brain injuries, some of which can only be diagnosed after in a post-mortem. How did they talk to you about living with injuries that were incurred many years ago?
Unfortunately, I was not able to interview Fred Lorenzen, the driver who was voted into the Hall of Fame in May. He has been diagnosed with dementia. He lives in a nursing home in Chicago. His daughter believes that he has a disease that we've seen in football players and in hockey players. That disease can only be, it's called CTE. And his daughter believes that Fred Lorenzen has that condition. Can't be diagnosed as long as he's alive. I don't know how to put this, but at some point it's possible that Fred Lorenzen could wind up being the first driver to ever be diagnosed with this condition.
Mm. What sort of injury are most common in these wrecks or crashes for NASCAR drivers?
Well, if you're in a car accident, you can imagine there are any number of injuries, head injuries, broken arms, broken legs. Drivers have raced with every sort of injury you can imagine. Burns. Dale Earnhardt Jr. years ago suffered significant burns in a crash. But, you know, a lot of those injuries can be healed. Now, the injuries to the brain, they can be devastating. They can have lasting effects. They may not – those effects – may not be felt for decades after, which is why there needs to be so much focus on concussions in NASCAR and in any sport.
What are some of the long-term effects of head injuries that could come from these kind of high-impact car wrecks?
Well, what we're seeing and what I discovered in talking with a number of drivers is a lot of drivers have memory loss from concussions. They don't remember what they did yesterday. I had a long discussion with Bobby Allison and his wife about the issues that he's facing, and his wife told me 30 minutes after I leave, he will not remember the conversation that we were currently having. It's sort of devastating to hear drivers as beloved as him struggling in that way. There are a number of other issues. What we've seen is mood swings in drivers who have had numerous concussions. We have not seen, as far as I can tell, the suicides in other sports that we've NASCAR has not experienced that. But really some very devastating issues. One driver talked about depression, that he had been on 15 different medications to deal with depression that could be very well directly associated with his traumatic brain injury in his wreck.
Well, Viv, thank you so much for your time, especially at a busy time for you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
According to the National Sleep Foundation, up to 15% of Americans experience sleepwalking. While certain therapies, such as hypnosis and antidepressants, have been shown to reduce incidence of sleepwalking, there is no specific treatment for the condition. Even back in the 19th century, there were efforts to cure it. This piece comes from Backstory with the American History Guys and producer Eric Mennel.
On the night of June 24th, 1833, Dr. Lemuel Belden received a message. There were concerns about the behavior of a young girl in Springfield, Massachusetts.
I was called under the impression that she was deranged, and such at first was my own belief. She was struggling to get out of bed, complaining very much at the same time of pain in the left side of her head. Her face was flushed, the head hot, eyes closed, and her pulse much excited.
Jane C. Ryder was a servant for a wealthy family, and she had had a fairly long history of sleep disturbances that went back into her childhood.
This is Benjamin Reese. He teaches at Emory University, and he stumbled onto Jane Ryder's story a few years back.
It was reported that she often slept too long, and that as a child she had a number of episodes of sleepwalking. And those started to get more intense as she came to work for this family.
At first, the paroxysms...
A paroxysm is a fit or an attack.
...occurred only in the night, and generally soon after she went to bed. As the disease advanced, they commenced earlier. She then fell asleep in the evening, sitting in her chair, or rather, passed into the state of somnambulism. For her sleep, under those circumstances, was never natural.
So some of the things that she would do in the middle of the night would be setting the table perfectly for breakfast.
Having dressed herself, she went downstairs and skimmed the milk, poured the cream into one cup and the milk into another, all without spilling a drop. She then cut the bread, placed it regularly on the plate, and divided the slices in the middle. And this, with her eyes closed, she finally returned voluntarily to bed.
And when she'd wake up in the morning, she'd wonder,
why had somebody else done my job for me while I was sleeping?
Eventually, word of Jane's behavior got around. Her sleep-induced chores were written up in the local newspaper, and people wanted to see for themselves.
People would show up to watch the spectacle of her strange nighttime activities. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear exactly how people knew when to show up, but there don't seem to be any reports of people turning away dissatisfied. She was something of a medical curiosity.
It got to the point where Jane was not only doing work in her sleep, she was undoing work. Work she was paid to do. Things like pulling clothes from her dresser and hiding them in places she couldn't find when she woke.
And apparently after a while, this became bothersome to the family that was employing her. They decided, and apparently Jane herself agreed.
Arrangements were made for Jane's removal to the hospital in Worcester.
The state lunatic asylum, which had only opened the year before.
Where she could enjoy that seclusion which seemed essential for her cure.
What's important to note here is that just a few years prior, Jane wouldn't have been considered insane. In the 18th century, insanity was an entire way of being.
A complete delusional set of beliefs or a kind of reversion to an almost animalistic state of behavior.
But by the time Jane Ryder was making breakfast in bed,
the concept of partial insanity took hold, and that is that you could be completely sane in most aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. But there would be one set of behaviors that could set you off, either religious delusion or some kind of fixation or troublesome behaviors in your sleep. So insanity started to become fractionalized in a way.
A lot of this was caught up in ideas similar to phrenology, that different areas of your skull revealed different personality traits. The skull, the brain, and madness were all being broken down into their component parts in the 19th century. And with medical advances, scientists thought that if you could locate madness, you could cure it. Essentially, everything must be curable. Which is exactly how Jane C. Ryder, a young female servant who sleepwalked, was placed in the asylum system, a system mostly populated by the criminally insane.
December 15th. Paroxysm rather singular. She is full of melancholy like a roguish child. December 19th. She was more disposed to melancholy. She once said her head ached and felt strangely. She appeared very much like a person insane. December 21st. Very well and wakeful all day, but in the evening had a paroxysm of complete insanity. Talked, ran about the house, and refused to take her medicine. When forced to take it, she shed tears and fell into a sort of hysterical sobbing, which lasted some minutes.
Belden thought the problems were food-related. Specifically, he blamed her restlessness on eating too much dried fruit. But even controlling Jane's diet didn't fix the problem. so doctors were forced to try more drastic cures.
To warm the feet, which were always cold, the nitromuriatic acid bath was prescribed.
She was given everything from opium to ether to medications that would make her vomit.
Her head was also shaved.
Leeches were applied. She was bled profusely. She had
leeches?
She was blistered also. Pus would ooze out. There was some thought that it would draw out whatever fluids were not harmonized within her body causing her to behave in this way. So she went through this very painful and difficult set of treatments and experiments. And after a while, it was clear she wanted to get out of there.
Kind friend, as it was your wish that I should write to you respecting my health, I have a good opportunity now.
This is from a letter Ryder wrote to Belden just before being dismissed from the asylum. And reading the letter, the words don't seem like those of a woman who's effectively been a lab rat for the past few months. They seem more like a woman who wants to leave and will say whatever she needs to make that happen.
I am very happy to say I'm much better now and think that being a little more unwell than usual has had a very good effect. The time has passed very quickly.
Do the doctors in the end feel like they've cured her?
In the final write-up of the case, they said that her symptoms had become much more manageable, which was, in a way, an admission that they couldn't completely cure the problem. Hmm. Now, asylum superintendents at that time, they always had an out because they claimed that mental illness was universally curable if it was caught early in its development. Hmm. And so they often took pains when they couldn't cure somebody to show that this was a disease that had been growing for years and years before that it was ever brought to their attention. And the fact that Jane Ryder had been experiencing bouts of sleepwalking since she was a young girl helped give them cover.
One thing that was interesting about this story is like, where I can't tell if by putting her in an asylum, it's a humanitarian effort that they want to treat her. That seems like that's what Belden, the doctor, it seems like that's his motivation. But simultaneously, it seems like the family, her employers, are trying to just kind of get her out of their hair. I mean, do you get a sense that both those things are working in confluence with each other, or one is more powerful than the other?
I think both are working together, and they're often indistinguishable from each other. The reigning idea behind the asylum movement was that all people had access to mental health and to productive lives, and that when medical conditions prevented them from fulfilling their potential, that society had an obligation to restore them to full capacity. That was the PR, and often the reality was quite different when people who were simply inconvenient to others, as Jane Ryder seemed to become to her employers, found themselves incarcerated either through coercion or through outright involuntary confinement. That tension between the humanitarian mission and the control of unruly individuals was always present through the history of the asylum.
And we don't know what happened to her after she left the asylum?
Well, we know she went back to working as a servant. Mm-hmm. And periodically, newspaper and magazine reporters would inquire into the case and give brief accounts of how she was doing. But she slips back into the obscurity of the world of 19th century serving women.
It's strange to think that mental illness might have been a way out of that obscurity, even if temporarily. And it's difficult to know what Ryder was actually thinking. After all, she wrote these letters knowing full well they would be read by the doctors treating her. Whatever the case, it was these letters, and others like them, that helped give authority to the asylum movement, that helped launch a century and a half of institutionalization.
I feel as if I never could repay my friends for all they have done for me. Indeed, I know I never can. All I can do is thank them and deny myself everything that would be injurious to my health. I have nothing more present to write. Your most obedient friend, Jane C. Ryder.
And that story brought to us by Backstory with the American History Guys and producer Eric Mennel. Up next, we're going to head to the frontiers of modern-day medicine, the science and ethics of artificial wombs. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. People wanting to have children have many more options than they used to. Still, adoption, surrogacy, in vitro fertilization, and all the other methods depend on reproductive biology. In other words, someone has to carry and eventually give birth to each human baby. But what if there were another way? From Aldous Huxley's Brave New World to the Matrix trilogy, science fiction has long imagined babies gestating from conception to delivery in a lab. Artificial wombs may soon be a reality. Zoltan Istvan is a futurist and a philosopher and journalist and author. He wrote about the science and ethics of artificial wombs, or ectogenesis, as the technology is formerly called, for Motherboard. Zoltan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, so first of all, what does this term ectogenesis actually mean?
Well, in theory, it really just means having a living organism in an artificial womb or outside of the human body. That's the technical term. But what it's really kind of come to mean is more the matrix feeling of, you know, growing a human body outside of the mother. And, you know, just gives us a lot of sci-fi kind of feelings to it.
And that image, you know, you mentioned the matrix. I think of that scene with all of those sort of pods where humans are growing. What would the technology for ectogenesis look like in real life?
You know, in real life, it's going to be a lot more, I would say, human friendly. I almost imagine it as giant aquariums filled with amniotic fluid, very easily to be visible, lots of cameras and a number of wires kind of going into a growing fetus. And you'd be able to monitor it and perhaps even stimulate it. There might be things that you could do to create a kind of feeling of love or something being applied to it, even though it is, you know, separate in this type of container.
Why would a parent, especially a mother, opt for external gestation in an artificial womb?
Well, you know, so this is the number one question. I'm going to give you my emotional point of view because it's something I was not didn't do in the article, but I recently had my second daughter, and my wife had to go through a C-section. And I can tell you, as a husband watching one's, you know, the most important person in your life be cut open, organs are spilling out. It's very shocking to see that something like that happen. And yes, our procedure went safe, but it's not a safe surgery. It's a major surgery. And so from just going through this incredible, dangerous ordeal is my reason that I would want ectogenesis. So I don't have to actually worry about my wife dying on the operating table. Or also it's quite crude actually to pull a child from that environment and hope it starts breathing and then put it and clean it all up. And that first the child can't breathe because there's a lot of mucus and blood and stuff all over. The environment of doing, you know, an artificial womb would be far safer, far cleaner, far more managed. And you could there'd be a lot of different type of technologies that would just literally eliminate, you know, you're talking like 95% of the risks of childbirth. And don't forget that 800 women a day die, according to the World Health Organization, die a day from childbirth. It's a very serious thing.
Well, how close are we to making this technology a reality now?
Well, so we have most of the technology available to start experimenting with this, with human fetuses and such. We really do. The problem is that there are rules, there is legislation, there's bureaucracy, and there's just public opinion to worry about. They've already grown a goat fetus who, you know, full term, it's not that big of a step to do that with a human being. It would probably take 2 to 3 years of developing the technology. But what really is getting in the way and what could be 10, 20, and 30 years out is whether governments are going to allow this, because who's going to experiment on a child and have it go wrong? Those kind of trials would be almost unimaginable in our society that, you know, doesn't like to do those kind of things. So the technology is basically here. The possibility of doing it is quite far out.
We're speaking about ectogenesis, or in layman's terms, the artificial womb, with Zoltán István. He's a futurist, philosopher, and author. Well, Zoltán, let's say that artificial wombs do become a safe and viable option for hopeful parents someday. There is the argument that this takes the burden off of women to carry and give birth to a child. I'd love to hear more. Can you illuminate some of the ethical arguments for and against ectogenesis?
Well, sure. I think, you know, primarily the most important argument in favor of ectogenesis is the fact that you're going to be able to monitor your child from basically being a zygote all the way to a delivery date. And I'm not sure if that delivery date's going to be 9 months anymore. Might be out further, might be 18 months. Whatever is best for the development of the human brain. And you know what's great is you're going to be able to monitor every heartbeat. You're going to be able to, you know, monitor the movements. You're going to be able to feed it the very best nutrients it gets. The mom no longer gets sick and has the flu. Now, also, you know, from a woman's working point of view, a professional point of view, it's also going to be favorable if they don't want to take time off or have maternity leave. A lot of people have suggested that the discrepancy between women's wages and men's wages for the same job has a lot to do with maternity leave. So I think women might be able to use it who want to have children, but who also don't want to give up their careers.
But this also brings up questions about ethical dilemmas surrounding issues like designer babies, for example, or genetic pretesting, you know, that you can create a baby with a higher IQ, but then what if its IQ doesn't quite measure up? Then is the fetus just expendable? You know, this sort of things. Are these questions being thrashed out anywhere?
So you're getting into kind of the frontiers of these questions, which are so fascinating to me as a futurist. You know, this is, again, why this subject is such a political minefield, is the idea of designer babies. Yes, it's exactly what would happen is people would then, and we're already, you know, at the level of trying to start doing designer babies. You will probably see that happening in the next 2 or 3 years as people start choosing sexes, as people start, you know, trying to eliminate bad genes and stuff like that. And of course, in ectogenesis, in the artificial womb, people would be doing that exact same thing, except to even a further extent. And yes, would they say, you know, some babies are expendable if it's not measuring up to what they wanted? Of course. And this kind of gets into abortion in, you know, in an artificial womb. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. When does murder, you know, when does murder come into play, or whatever the law of the land is, depending on the state and stuff like that? And this is why this story is such a political minefield. And I think ectogenesis is still much further out, despite the technology essentially being here.
You mentioned the possibility of increasing equality among the sexes because women alone would not be responsible for carrying the child, giving birth to the child. But there's also some dubiousness among feminists who believe that science is going to be taking over something sacred and exclusive to women. Any discussions of that?
Well, yes. And, you know, I must say I'm going to side with some of the feminists on this point and just say it's true. It's very much true. If you subscribe value to being a person who can actually give birth, you know, through your human parts, then that is a very sacred thing to lose and a very sacred thing to give to science. However, the question really comes into being is what is the most functional thing, not only for society, but for the individual? And this is where we get into both the safety of the human being and the safety of the child itself. So this, again, it's not a clear cut, oh, this is right or this is wrong. It's really going to probably come down to a very personal choice and whether a mother wants to actually give up that very sacred and very special thing that they have been doing for, you know, so many hundreds of thousands of years now.
Zoltán István, so fascinating. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Zoltan Istvan is a futurist. He's a philosopher, journalist, and author. And he wrote the article, Artificial Wombs Are Coming, But the Controversy Is Already Here for Motherboard. You'll find a link to read that article at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to know what you think. Is ectogenesis a technology that should stay in the pages of science fiction novels and on films? Do you think it would have a positive impact on families and society? Or would you wish to forego pregnancy in favor of using an artificial womb? You can let us know what you think by posting a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Thank you so much for joining us today. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Ellen Vollinger from the Food Research and Action Center about the SNAP Challenge, which encourages people to try living on the average daily food stamp benefit for 1 week. As of April, the average daily benefit is $4.15.
We have gotten a lot of reports from people who've taken the SNAP Challenge. Number one, they do find it difficult to afford a balanced diet. One of the other things, however, that we hear from people who take the SNAP Challenge is how surprised they are by the monotony of what they've been consuming over a week.
If you'd like to try the SNAP Challenge, you'll find all the information you need to get started on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.